Hi, this is Smriti Kirvanandan, your host for Health Forward Podcast. One of the most important things you can do for yourself is to take care of your health. Your road to discovering an all-inclusive, empathetic, and innovative healthcare ecosystem starts right now. The U.S. healthcare ranks last among top 11 high-income countries. We spend a lot more and our outcomes display poorer healthcare quality. High infant mortality rates and less life expectancy are few of the pressing concerns. Today, I'll be discussing how does American healthcare look from a global perspective with Bernard Tony Jr. Former White House medical officer, has served the U.S. Army and is now working for the National Institute of Health. Welcome to Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to engaging in the dialogue with you. Thank you.
So, Bernard, what has inspired you to join the field of health?
Well, I'll tell you that my introduction to health was rather traumatic. I was about 17 years old, and I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was a victim of a drive-by shooting in which my good friend, Ivan Gray, succumbed to his wounds. He was shot in the chest, and I held him to his last breaths here on Earth. And so that was one of the experiences in my life that I can say that I felt the most helpless. But I knew that I wanted to be able to put myself in a position so that if I were ever in a position like that again, I would have the tools, the resources, and the knowledge to be able to affect the change, you know, within my capability. So that was my, you know, sort of the nexus between myself and wanting to actually go into the healthcare field. Global health was actually more so related to my time in Afghanistan, doing what we call medical civic action programs, and seeing the level of extreme poverty and how when basic needs aren't met, people tend to die from largely preventable diseases. So that's sort of how I gained an interest into global health writ large.
During your time as a White House medical officer, you have made some significant impact working during the time of the pandemic and beyond. What are some of the learnings you would like to share?
Yeah, so, you know, I can say that, you know, when I was a part of the White House medical unit, as you can imagine, I had, you know, probably the best leadership that I could have ever wanted to be under during a pandemic, a global pandemic. That leadership was very agile and flexible and being able to leverage a lot of the resources that we have at our disposal that I understand many other places don't, with CDC epidemiologists, you know, Department of Defense, you know, so many different elements were able to come together and pivot quite quickly with respect to COVID mitigation. But I would say that, you know, what I did learn as a part of the unit outside of the White House, part of my job was to also look at health systems as a part of medical planning. And I learned that we, as the United States at that time, we needed to increase our level of preparedness. And that was readily apparent when I was at a particular hospital in Seattle, and I was with a member of the leadership, trauma leadership team, and they spoke about the fact that that they didn't have the adequate amount of PPE, which was a jarring fact, considering that we're the richest nation in the world. So that let me know that we needed to definitely increase our level of preparedness within the country, and it was going to take a whole of government approach, definitely leadership from the top to be able to drive that. And beyond that, I looked at the fact that our public health infrastructure is woefully underfunded at the local, state, and you know, arguably at the global level as well. So we quickly realized that we didn't have the appropriate number of human resources for healthcare. Our information channels were not developed in a concerted way so that we can convey information quickly. And we struggled with our communication to the public, I would say, with respect to the COVID-19 pandemic and how things were evolving. And you know, I think they weren't ready to display for many people to see. Beyond what we were providing from a healthcare perspective, I think inequity within our healthcare system was definitely on display. And And I think that's something that I hope to be able to affect as we move forward.
A lot of things for us to work on, and it's impressive to hear this, you know, kind of an inside view of what's working, what's not working, and what needs to change from also leadership point of view and not just bottom up. That brings me to the next question. As the United States ranks last overall compared to all other countries, despite spending far more of its GDP on healthcare, and the US ranks last on access to care, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. What are your thoughts in this space?
Yeah, so I know exactly where that data came from. It came from the Commonwealth Fund and their report that they recently presented. And I'll tell you that they were right in many ways. They looked at essentially five domains. They looked at access to care. They looked at care process, administrative efficiency, equity, and health outcomes. And we, like many other places in the world, we have our challenges. I can say at least, you know, I think the most prominent element of this is the fact that we don't have in the United States universal healthcare, which if you look at many of the other countries that are mentioned in the Commonwealth Fund's report, they looked at countries that had a system that was covered the general population, the entire population, at least at the most basic level. And so in the United States, we struggle with the fact that we still have about, according to that report, about 30 million people that are uninsured and about 40 million people who are underinsured, meaning that they may have coverage, but they may not have enough coverage to meet catastrophic spending caps, if you will, if they're sick with a terminal disease, or they are a patient that's involved in a very traumatic experience that requires a lot of intensive care in a hospital. Some of those patients may or may not have the coverage, if you will, to be able to meet those costs. And so, I think that universal healthcare is one of the challenges that we have. We've tried, you know, to meet that with the Affordable Care Act, with varying degrees of success. But I think that we definitely need to work towards a solution in which that we can cover our entire population, at least with the most basic of health services. The challenge of that is complicated. We have, you know, health coverage for people who are economically disadvantaged with Medicaid. We have health coverage for the elderly, which is Medicare. We have, you know, many businesses will offer health care plans and insurance through their employment requirements to their employees, but not everyone's covered in those populations, and not everyone's evenly covered in a equitable sense. So that's one of our challenges. We definitely have the same income gradient issues that other countries have, where we have the poor have access to perhaps less quality care, or sometimes less access to care as the rich, or people who are more economically advantaged. We definitely still have urban to rural disparities as well. Many of our best health systems and access to great healthcare are centralized in urban areas. So I think those are some of the overarching things that we need to look at. Driving down a little bit deeper, our administrative costs. We spend, as you well know, about close to 17% of our GDP on healthcare. A lot of that is driven by administrative costs. We have to do a root cause analysis, if you will, to figure out how can we simplify insurance plans, billing, payment systems, to make it, you know, in a way that is more efficient and costs the end user, if you will, the patients, less when it comes to the healthcare spending that's required. There's a lot of things that go into that, you know, the pandemic, if you will, has shown us. For example, we look at back office functions, billing and coding and things like that. Usually health systems will house a lot of those back office functions on campus. The pandemic allowed many of those people to telework, meaning that now maybe hospital systems don't have to rent those buildings to be able to keep those people employed. A lot of times they're more efficient, and those savings can be translated into, expanding healthcare options inequity within those health systems within their footprint. We need to focus on primary care prevention. That's one thing that many of the other countries have done a very good job at doing, is focusing a lot of their efforts on primary care and prevention. If we can do that, I think that we might not need a lot of the highly specialized care that costs so much money in the United States. But again, there's a lot of different things that we need to do to be able to close these gaps. And I think that we'll have to address this from a multifactorial perspective, and certainly look at things from not only a healthcare, you know, healthcare delivery perspective, but also looking at cross-sectoral approaches that decrease the burden of disease. And that's working with schools, communities, affordable housing, and so many other areas that have an indirect impact on healthcare writ large.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned root cause analysis and, you know, kind of concentrating into that we need to make healthcare simple. And as individuals, we need to be more proactive in using healthcare as well. I think those are just brilliant points. So thank you so much for sharing. So what are some innovative and scalable solutions you have witnessed in healthcare within America in your service to the Army and the White House and now with the NIH?
Well, I can tell you that within the United States and the Army, I think the most remarkable thing that I've seen in my adult life with respect to mitigating an infectious disease such as COVID-19 was Operation Warp Speed. As I traveled around the country, I was able to see the different elements that went into Operation Warp Speed. But nonetheless, it was a partnership between the Department of Health and Human Services, which that's who I work for now as a member of the NIH, and the Department of Defense. And that's where I came from, in the U.S. Army. The Operation Warp Speed was aimed to accelerate the development of the COVID-19 vaccine. That whole of government, whole of society approach was phenomenal and remarkable in ways that I think surprised many of us. You know, I think even Bill Gates mentioned that when he was looking at how soon a vaccine would be readily available, he was looking more on the 18 to 24 month side, and we did that in about a year. And Operation Warp Speed had a lot to do with that. So I think that that advancement, you know, that level of consistency and commitment to change is something that we can translate into other areas as we're working, you know, in a global health perspective. For example, Operation Warp Speed identified many supply chain issues and identified new partners, if you will, with being able to develop vaccines, distribute them, and get them to where they need to be quickly and efficiently. I think now that we've been able to look at this from a macro perspective and do it in a record time that we, you know, no one's ever seen, if we can, you know, take these lessons learned and apply those lessons to, let's say, helping lower and middle income countries with their development of vaccines for routine illnesses and their supply chain issues, and taking those lessons learned to be able to affect change on a broader scale and scaling it up is something that I think we can do. And I hope to see that in the near future.
Yeah, as much as we have, I believe, a lot to share and educate other countries, it's mutual. So I think as America, we have a lot to learn. So what are the other countries, in your perspective, are doing in terms of health equity that we as a country are not?
Well, I'll share with you, you know, one thing that I'll look at from the COVID-19 perspective, and then another thing from, I'll say, just general healthcare. I was very impressed with the way that the sequencing of genomes are done in Africa. So Africa has the Africa Pathogen Genomics Initiative, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's basically an array of laboratories that are able to quickly detect and sequence pathogens in a way that is remarkably fast. We didn't have anything like that, that I know of in the United States. And, you know, case in point, the project, or, you know, we'll call it the Africa PGI, they were responsible for identifying two remarkably impactful variants for the COVID-19 virus, the Delta and the Omicron variant. And so that level of network, which was really based on the fact that they were focused more on infectious disease, such as HIV, and we are not burdened with those types of infectious diseases as much in the United States, I think that they do that exceptionally well. And if we can, you know, take some of those best practices and incorporate them, not just at the federal level, but also down at the state and local level, I think we would have a more preparedness for a potential pandemic in the future. Beyond the COVID-19 perspective, I tend to focus a lot on Norway because I'm really impressed with what they do just within their healthcare system. Mental health is a big topic right now in the United States as we look at gun violence. You know, that's one of the hot topic items in the news. And a lot of it points to mental health issues. Where Norway has figured out a way to not only provide universal health coverage, but also provide mental health services for all children under the age of 15, fully covered by the federal government. And I think that's fairly remarkable because, you know, if you can address a lot of these issues earlier on, they may, you know, not be as pervasive or even present in the future. And so I think that's really remarkable. If we can do something like that in the United States, I think that will be ideal. Another thing that that many other countries, such as Sweden, they embed their behavioral health providers within their primary care teams. So if you're going to your primary care physician or provider, you likely have access to a behavioral health specialist that's in close proximity. Ironically, we do the same thing in the United States Army, where we have embedded behavioral health to be able to provide essentially a one-stop shop for our patients and the added benefit of the mental health professionals that can crosstalk with the primary care providers and deliver comprehensive medical care. So again, I think that many countries have a lot of best practices that we can take from.
I love these data points, and also the point you're kind of focusing more is on how do we focus on individuals and patients in a holistic format and not just based on individual episodic disease state. That's just wonderful to hear that insight and inspiration we need to extract from other countries. U.S. ranks 24th in the world for environmental performance. Such factors play a huge role in our day-to-day lives, especially in healthcare. What do you believe we need to do as a country to keep up?
Yeah, so I think that environmental considerations are extremely important in the United States, just like they are in many other countries. One thing that we have the benefit of in the United States is that we are energy secure. You know, energy security is very important. And essentially what that means is, in almost all instances, if we walk into a room and we want to turn on a light, that'll happen. If we want to, you know, cook, the stove will turn on. So we're very secure with our energy. The challenge, though, is as a part of our rapid development in the United States through industrialization and now where we are today, we've become very dependent on fossil fuels. And so those fossil fuels create, you know, a condition in which we have greenhouse gas emissions and other you know, things that affect people on a regular basis, and we need to get a better handle on that. Unfortunately, you know, I try to talk to people about, you know, do you know how much reliance we have on fossil fuels? And it's not just gasoline. It's not just plastics. It's literally everything that we touch every single day. The products that we use, if we drink bottled water, that bottle is made of plastic, but it also took, you know, usually trucking industries that, you know, emit a lot of carbon into the atmosphere to be able to move those bottles across the country. And all of that is based on crude oil and fossil fuels. We need to figure out a way to develop new technologies with what we have. Solar is great, but the sun doesn't always shine. Wind is awesome, but the wind doesn't always blow. So I think we need to really, as a country, invest in research and development so that we can figure out ways to create more sustainable energy and store that energy. While we do have a lot of ways to create energy, we will need a lot of storage capacity as well. That's going to take a lot of research development. If from the government perspective, I think that's where a lot of investment is going to need to pivot if we're going to move in that direction. I think that it's really difficult to make these changes. You know, energy improvements won't happen overnight. So we'll need to figure out, you know, a tax credit system and incentives to be able to incentivize, you know, companies and even individuals to move towards cleaner energy solutions. I think that, you know, we have a lot of options that are on the table. Some people like the idea of a carbon tax, basically putting a dollar amount on the amount of carbon that businesses emit into the atmosphere. But we have to think about the economic considerations. A lot of people's livelihoods depend upon, you know, the oil industry, the hydrofracking industry. We'll need to figure out ways to invest not only in the technology to transition to cleaner solutions, clean energy solutions, but also invest in those people that worked so hard to be able to create that energy for us that we benefit from every single day. From a leadership perspective, governance is going to be very important. Public policies, clean fuel standards, things like that will definitely have to come from the top and drive a lot of this. But social levers are important as well. You'll be surprised if you talk to people about the things that are impacting our environment, the things that are impacting climate change. A lot of people don't know, and it feels quite frankly overwhelming for many people, and they don't feel like they have a lot of ways to benefit the country writ large. So I think we need to focus on education so that, you know, the general population knows ways that they themselves can reduce their carbon footprint, but also ways that they can become more involved in demanding as, you know, citizens and as constituents to demand from their elected officials to move towards clean energy solutions.
So Bernard, do you believe we are prepared for the future of pandemics?
If you're asking me to say, to answer that in one sentence, I would say no, not yet. But in the famous words of Hans Rosling, he said, remember things can be bad and getting better at the same time. Our preparedness for future pandemics is better than it was before the COVID-19 pandemic. But we can't lose our interest, our investment, and we have to keep it as one of the top priorities at the table for all levels of government. Just case in point, we don't have a way to, in a meaningful way, work with other nations in a concerted effort to be able to mitigate future pandemics as it stands now. We did increase our communication, and we were able to flatten communication and work more quickly during the COVID-19 pandemic. But I would say that we need to do a better job at that, and we need to figure out a way that we have a committed force or large team, if you will, you know, that is multilateral, multi-nation, that can be able to respond to pandemics in the future. Part of that is that we have to strengthen healthcare systems. So if you look at low-income countries, it's not enough to detect that they are, you know, being impacted or potentially impacted by a pathogen, but they have to have a way to get tested. They have to have a way to get treatment. And a lot of that is going to go back to healthcare strengthening for particularly these low-income countries so they can get their foot on the first, their foot on the first rung of the development ladder. If we can do that and get them at least to a middle income country status, then at that point they can start focusing on ways to, you know, innately take care of many of the issues that may burden them. I think that we need to build capacity in manufacturing and distributing vaccines. One of the things that I highlight when I talk about vaccine development is not just creating the vaccines, but we need to turn them into vaccinations that actually go into arms. And a lot of that is the supply chains that are not existent in many places around the world. And in many places around the world, we don't have that last mile covered. And what that means is we can create vaccines, we can deliver these vaccines to countries around the world with formidable speed, as you saw, over the first year of the pandemic. But that last mile, once we get it to the remote areas, the rural areas, if they don't have the electricity to be able to support the extreme cold temperatures, let's say for like the Pfizer vaccine, then it doesn't do us any justice to get it to the country and even get it to the village. We still have to have a way to store it and get it into the arms of people. And I think that's one of the things that we need to work on with respect to development, for all of these low and middle income countries. And that brings about another element of research and development. Maybe we need to start thinking about better ways to develop vaccines, vaccines that you can inhale, nasal vaccines, therapeutics that come in pill form that people can take if they are infected. You know, a lot of this requires more investment in research and development, not just for high income countries, but for low income countries as well. I mean, then we need to have an integrated public health system. As you well saw in the United States, we have great people working at these health departments, but they've been woefully underfunded at all levels. And we need to figure out ways that they can communicate with each other from the local, state, and at the national level, but not stopping there. We need to be able to expand that communication to other countries and codify that in a way that is regularly tested, drilled, exercised quite frequently, so that we can have confidence and that we are better prepared to respond to another pandemic that inevitably will come.
I'm 100% with you, and just excellent points. The message is to, one, work in integration with each other in communities and across countries, and also make sure that we're working at solutions that's innovative, accessible, and also affordable is just, I think, one of the foundational problems we need to work on. Mona, thank you so much for joining Health Forward. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. This is Health Forward Podcast, and I'm your host, Smriti Kirbanandan.